Friday, July 16th, 2010. Glad to be back with you. I tell you, the last Thursday night, actually even at 8 o'clock, I went and I was having dinner with one of my friends, Chuck Gillespie, that he was on the show with me a couple of weeks ago. And at 8 o'clock, Ernie called me up and said, "Hey, man, you doing the show tomorrow?" I was like, "Sure." And middle of the night, I got some scorching food poisoning. So I was so sick and throwing up and things, I had to have my wife call Manny, the board operator at the RBN studios, and ask him to put on an archived show because Daddy wasn't feeling too good. I really was sick. My wife begged me to go to the hospital, but you know, as hardheads, we don't want to go. Plus, I was a nurse for all those years, and I know exactly what they were going to do to me because I've done the same thing to countless people, and I didn't want any part of it. Anyway, we got a good show for you today. We are going to be talking about a lot of different things. I'm going to be a little bit all over the map because I'm going to be covering some things that haven't really been covered that much in these alternative news outlets. There's a couple of things that I've alluded to in past shows that I wanted to discuss. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Bakken oil reserve that is in, you know, the central United States between Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. We are going to talk about an article that was written in 1978 by Murray Rothbard called The Tyranny of the Bench. And I talk a lot about how the judiciary is a rubber stamp for what the government is trying to do when the intent of the judiciary is for them to be an independent arbiter. At the top of the next segment, Drew Phillips actually decided to come in and run the board for me today, which I'm very thankful. He had an actual run-in with Governor Jan Brewer last night, and I always love to hear those stories because Drew has a really unassuming manner, real easygoing character, so I think he kind of draws these people in and then puts the smack down on them. And I actually learned a lot about how I conduct my own interviews from Drew because, you know, you get more flies with honey. You know what I'm saying, baby? You get more flies with honey rather than going out there and putting someone immediately on the defensive, which is certainly the first thing I would like to do. You know, I'd like to go out there and do a little more than shout at most of these people. I'd like to crack them upside the noggin. But, you know, civil society and whatnot, you just can't do it. So I learned from Drew and, you know, other people as well that you, by going up there and being unassuming and asking direct, honest questions, you tend to get a little more out of them. We also are going to be talking about an article by Andrew Gavin Marshall called The New Eugenics and the Rise of the Global Scientific Dictatorship from Global Research. I think it's a really, really excellent article. It's part three of a huge article he's been writing on. And we'd love to take your calls here at 1-800-313-9443. That number again, 800-313-9443. I really look forward to hearing from you. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Drew Phillips about his run-in with the governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, when we come back in just a minute. Hold on to yourselves.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the bees. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the bees.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock, and the revolution continues with me, Jet Lacy. I got Drew Phillips sitting in with me on the board, and we were talking in the opening here about him running in with Jan Brewer, and this isn't the first time he's run in with Jan Brewer. If you look on, I believe it's on your We Are Change, right? He ran into her at the fair, and he got a classic interview with her then. So, Drew, tell us a little bit about your run-in with Jan Brewer last night.
Well, it wasn't as eventful as the previous encounter because it was we were at Politics on the Rock, which is a Republican networking event they hold in Scottsdale at some yuppie bar, And it was packed last night because, as some of you out there may know, Jan Brewer, our governor, has, as the media has dubbed her, has achieved Palin status and is like the idol of the conservative movement because of her passing of the controversial immigration law down here in Arizona. So, and to build that story up in this Republican primary that's going on, we had the two other Republicans running against her, who have a lot of had a lot of money behind them, both since dropped out, Buzz Mills and Dean Martin. So she's running basically alone in the primary now. She's
Isn't there a guy, Matt Jetty, or
there is another Republican, there's another independent, and then there's, you know, I mean, there's libertarians and Democrats, but basically what happened was she's hijacked this immigration issue so hard that the other candidates feel like they can't contend with her because it's like she's been chosen by the media as the anointed one. So, like I said, the two of them dropped out. But anyway, so at this event, you know, and this was on the heels of a lot of things, like the photo radar system that she takes credit for bringing down on the freeways, which isn't true, but we'll get to that. But so she had this event at Politics on the Rock and Rocks, and like I said, it was very packed in this bar in Scottsdale. And I actually got media credentials to go down there, and I thought that was surprising because I thought, you guys don't know who I am, do you? And you know, you don't understand my politics. So they gave me media credentials, and I got to sit in the back hallway near the kitchen area where they, the staging area where they let her in the back door, and then they let her into the kitchen where I didn't get to go, where there's, you know, a bouncer and stuff. And so I was sitting in the hallway. Shelton was there as well, and Channel whatever was there, and the news station was looking to do an interview with her. So anyway, she comes in and we're standing in the hallway. She walks by us and I just kind of left her alone at that moment. I didn't want to get kicked out yet. And so we're standing there in the hallway and then her, one of her staffers gets up and introduces her. And then she comes out of the back and they usher her up on the stage and she passes by us again. And at that point is when my man 4409 started in with his, you know, he's a, she just passed a initiative here, Prop 100, which was a sales tax, which essentially was about 17% if you look at it in the aggregate. And so he starts screaming, you know, tax lover, you know, a bailout lover. His whole thing was that this proposition equaled a bailout for the state of Arizona, which is essentially true. And so he starts yelling at her and, you know, I got up close to the stage, you know, maybe 10 feet away from her filming her speech, and I can hear in the background, you know, bailout lover, tax lover, and why are you raising our taxes? This is all coming from 4409, and that yelling is getting further and further away from me. You know, I'm not looking back, but I can hear it moving further and further back in the room as they're escorting Shelton out of the room as he's yelling. So I got to play good cop because he was, you know, he was being the aggressive one, so I just kind of kept my mouth shut, and I filmed her entire speech. She didn't say anything of interest. And then she got off. They gave her an award and a check and all this stuff, and you know, that made her feel good.
Was it a huge check?
Well, no. Somebody gave her a check for the legal defense fund for SB 1070. They're getting ready for this, you know, to go to court, and they actually filed an injunction yesterday, as Tom was reporting on the show yesterday. And they, you know, so they're getting ready for a big legal battle. So private contributors are giving them money because they're such in favor of the bill 1070 that they've decided to contribute financially to the legal defense fund. So anyway, yeah, they gave her an award and all this stuff. And so then I'm sitting in the back hallway again, waiting for her to come back. She comes back through and she made a beeline for the bathroom because it was hot in there. I mean, this is an air conditioned bar, but it was so packed that, you know, even the governor up on stage with the lights and everything, she was sweating, and the news station wanted to do an interview with her. So she was smart. She went to the bathroom to freshen up and get, you know, I could see her when she came off. There was sweat dripping off of her face. You know, she wasn't looking like her pretty self.
Pretty.
She ain't that pretty. That's not nice. So anyway, so she comes out of the bathroom and she granted the TV station the interview. So I just sat next, you know, stood next to the videographer from the news station and filmed the reporter doing the interview just to see if he would say anything interesting or she would say anything interesting. And then as soon as he finished, he got about three or four questions in. I just, you know, looking right at her, I said, Governor Brewer, will you pressure Red Flex? And this is a story we need to tell, but will you pressure Red Flex, the camera company, to take the cameras down sooner than 120 days? And all she did was she looked at me and said, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. And she could just hear the Channel 12 reporter. I'm yelling louder than him, but she can't hear me. And then I feel on the side of my ribs, on the side of my waist, her security guard kind of push me aside. And you know, and as I realized it was his, I knew his her bouncer was standing behind me. So when I felt that, I knew who it was. And he pushed me aside. She goes out the door, and then her entire entourage is following her out the door. I'm, you know, kind of behind her entourage, and they got her in the car quick. And you know, they didn't peel out, but it was like they did, and they got out the alley and got out of there. And then you know, that was pretty much it. So it really wasn't that big of an encounter, because you know, they didn't want her to spend any amount of time with me answering some hard questions about the photo radar program, which effectively ended last night at midnight on the freeways only, I should say.
However, you know, just as an aside to that, you were telling me before the show about you know, the cameras are still up, even though they're not, quote, flashing people. But you said that there was a news report that you watched from Fox 10 News here in Phoenix that said exactly what?
Well, and it was very poorly written article, because it didn't source who told the reporter this, whether it was the individual from Camera Fraud or whether it was the spokesperson for Redflex. So, again, terrible reporting on the behalf of Fox News. No surprise there. But it said that even though the cameras, I don't have it in front of me, but even though the cameras won't be flashing or issuing citations, that they'll still be monitoring traffic. It was never in the scope of the camera program to begin with to monitor traffic. It was in the scope to write citations for when you violated the speed, the thing would flash and you would get mailed the citation. It was never the scope of the program to monitor traffic. So, you know, just either poorly written article or poorly sourced or poorly researched. But regardless, what I noticed on my way in this morning into the shop was that the cameras are still up, as they, you know, we knew they would be. They have according to the contract, they have 120 days to remove the equipment from the freeways. The cameras are still up. I didn't see any flash. I mean, none of us were speeding because it was rush hour traffic, but they were still up. But all the signs are down. They by law, they had to have a sign. I think it was 300 feet
and then
half a mile, and they have to have signs that say photo enforcement zone. The signs are gone. The cameras are still there, and I saw one individual. It wasn't a dangerous situation, and there was no accident, but the individual came up to the cameras, saw the camera, not the signs, because the sign was gone, but saw the camera, and kind of tapped on their brakes real quick, and no one got into an accident. But that's what this is going to lead to, is now people are going to see the cameras, and they're going to be slamming on their brakes, whereas before they either were used to the signs or used to the placement of the cameras. And this individual probably didn't know that the camera wasn't flashing anymore and that the program is over, but just saw the camera and panicked and thought, oh no, am I speeding? Slammed on his brakes. And again, it didn't cause an accident, but this is the situation that could occur in the future, is where people are going to see these cameras not knowing they're not even on, and not have any warning from the signage, see the camera, hit the brakes, and this is going to cause rear-end accidents.
I wonder if they would do anything. This is just a thought. If people went around and start re-up the little sticky note, little thing that the people did in order to block the cameras from the first place. But then I want to see if they're, you know, that's a good test water to see if they are actually filming everybody when they're just going from place to place, because they were not only filming, but running your license plate every single time you went by one of those things to create a point of which at least your vehicle was at a certain location at a certain time.
Correct.
And so, of course, they didn't tell us these things. However, it's the truth. And so I wonder if they would be up in arms if people just went up and started putting sticky notes on the ones that are supposedly taken down again. Hint, hint, I'm not going to do it, but someone else might want to,
yeah,
you know.
You can't see Jet winking right now, but he is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. But all I do know is that Governor Jan Brewer has been very successful in carrying on Arizona's long-standing tradition of homely female governors. And this has been going on for a very long time. You understand, with Rose Mofford, Jane D. Hull, Janet Napolitano, and now Janice Brewer.
Brewdog.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's one thing. I tell you what, at least you can say this about Arizona. We got no problem electing the most ugly governors that the world has ever seen.
So
ever.
Cruel, Jet. So cruel.
I know. I'm feeling a little bit nasty today. I'm feeling arr, arr. When we come back on Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock, the revolution continues with me, Jet Lacy. I'm about to throw a revolution right here, right now. When we come back, I'd love to hear from you. 800-313-9443. We'll be right back. Hold on.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Bang me. Dang me, they ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me?
Hey, welcome back to Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. And the revolution continues. Me, Jet Lacy. I got Drew Phillips on the board talking about the governor and all this crazy stuff, you know. And, you know, Drew's the guy I usually go on out with and get all my interviews, and we have a pretty good working relationship, and I really enjoy when he comes down to, you know, spend some time with me on the show. Getting to the meat of what we're talking about here today, I had alluded to this numerous times on the show, and the document that I have in my hand is from the United States Geological Survey. And we're all out here in the Gulf, and they say they've capped it. I'll believe that when I see it. You know, provided they haven't ruined the crust of the earth in the process. But I just want to point out to you a certain thing, that we cannot have freedom in this country without energy independence. And we have so much available that is not being used on purpose. And there's this thing that I have, this article I have, is from the United States Geological Survey, and it's entitled Assessment of Undiscovered Oil Resources in the Devonian Mississippian Bakken Formation, Williston Basin Province, Montana and North Dakota, 2008. And it starts out, using a geologically based assessment methodology, the U.S. Geological Survey estimated a mean undiscovered volumes of 3.65 billion, with a B, barrels of oil, 1.85 trillion with a T cubic feet of associated dissolved natural gas, and 148 million barrels of natural gas liquids at the Bakken Formation of the Williston Basin Province, Montana and North Dakota. You know, the U.S. Geological Survey completed an assessment, and it says, for the resource summary, I'm running right to that because I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. But we have, in the Elm Coulee Billings Nose, they had 410 million barrels. Central Basin Popular Dome, 485 million barrels of oil. The Nesson-Kittle Knife Structural, they found 909 million barrels of oil. The Eastern Expulsion Threshold, 973 million barrels of oil. The Northwest Expulsion Threshold, 868 million barrels of oil, for a combined total of 3,645 million barrels of oil. And then there's a Middle Sandstone, which is the conventional oil resources, of 4, which brings the total 4 million barrels to 3,649 million barrels of oil, which means, you bring that over three places, 3.65 billion with a B barrels of oil. And I think that is in one reserve that is easily attainable. It's close to the surface, it's very safe, and it would provide the United States everything that we use for numerous years. And you want to talk, and that's just one reserve, okay? So when we look up all these different things that's going on, they absolutely have to keep us dependent on foreign oil. And that's just the way it is. And so if we don't break free from what is going on, we are being attacked in so many ways. We are being manipulated. We are being told lie after lie after lie that there is no need to go out in the deep water to drill in a mile of water to go down 30,000 feet to get oil. That was an ecological disaster waiting to happen. because they want it on international waters. They don't want more drilling on American soils, because that will bring revenue into the United States for us to use for our own purposes. They need to keep the division of the resources themselves and who gets the money from the resources separate, so they can tax us and tax us and tax us and control our economy and thus our society from every way you can imagine, because this is an oil-driven world and we have plenty of oil. But they can't let us accept that. They can't let us know that. They can't let us understand that and extract that oil for our own purposes, because then their shell game that they're playing with us would be up. Imagine. I mean, you look at the wealth that's been created by Saudi Arabia. I think, if my memory serves me correctly, that this Bakken Reserve itself has more oil than Saudi Arabia has left. So if you really think about that, and, you know, we've had Pastor Lindsey Williams on the show, and they're not even sure that oil is a fossil fuel anymore. So it's abiotic oil. It doesn't come from the corpses of dinosaurs. It is some sort of, you know, reaction that goes on within the earth that is a constantly renewing resource. So these are the things that we need to keep in mind when we listen to the news and they say we don't have any oil. When we come back on Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock and The Revolution Continues with me, Jet Lacy, we're going to jump into The Tyranny of the Bench, an article written in 1978 by Murray Rothbard that'll explain a lot about what I've been talking about the judiciary. Be right back.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
As arrogant men tear up our Constitution, and from every direction we cry revolution, standing together and without permission, soldiers for truth in the war of attrition, the love of our country. As our
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. The Revolution Continues to meet Jet Lacy. Got Drew Phillips on the board. That's our mutual friend, Jordan Page, rocking it out, telling the truth through his music. And I'll tell you what, I like that guy. And I really like him on numerous levels. I like his music. I don't typically tend to like the theme type of music, you know, when people just all sing about freedom and or this or that. I don't like a lot of the ethnic musics. I mean, I'm Irish, and I even don't like Irish music. But the thing is he really has got a beautiful voice, just him and a guitar, and he speaks the truth, and it really speaks to me on numerous levels and a very heartfelt and real level. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about this Murray Rothbard article from lourockwell.com. Murray Rothbard is unfortunately not been on this plane of existence since 1995, but his words are so very true. And this is the thing about libertarianism, okay, and Austrian economics. Libertarianism and Austrian economics are two, you know, thought processes that can also be easily transferred to your life. You know, being a libertarian, you can't live a democratic lifestyle unless you're leeching off the state, okay? You can't lead a Republican lifestyle. What does that mean? What does a democratic lifestyle mean? But you can lead a libertarian lifestyle, a lifestyle in which you simply decide that you will commit no force or fraud upon another individual, and you can reasonably expect that another individual not commit force or fraud on you. And so that's why these ideas, just because Murray Rothbard is no longer with us, it does not mean that his words do not live on and that these things that he says aren't still true today. They're actually more true today than they ever were. And so the title of the article is called The Tyranny of the Bench. And it was first published as The Plumb Line, So What Else Is New, in Libertarian Review, April 1978. He starts out, One of the fatal flaws in the concept of limited government is the judiciary. Endowed with the compulsory monopoly of the vital power of deciding disputes, of ultimately deciding who can wield force and how much can be wielded, the government judiciary sits as an unchecked and unlimited tyrant. I'd love to hear from you on this topic. 800-313-9443. 1-800-313-9443 if you have anything you want to talk about, or if you just have something you want to say, or if you want to talk. I would prefer to talk about this issue, but I look forward to your calls. 800-313-9443. It goes on, pledged to preside over the rule of law, the law that is supposed to apply to every man. The judges themselves are yet above the law and free from its sanctions and limitations. When clothed in the robes of office, the judge can do no legal wrong and therefore is immune from the law itself. There is a crucial catch-22 in this grisly situation. For if anyone would like to argue against this arrangement, he can do so. In our archist system, only before judges who themselves are part of the problem rather than part of the solution. It is up to government judges to rule on whether government judges are immune from the law. How do you think they would decide? Well, how do you think a group of economists would decide on the question of whether economists should be immune, or any other group or profession? Not surprisingly, the United States Supreme Court ruled in 1872 that judges were immune from any damage suits for any judicial acts that they had performed, regardless of how wrong, evil, or unconstitutional those acts may have been. When clothed in the judicial authority, judges can do no wrong, period. Recently, a case of an errant judge has come up again because his action as a judge was considered generally to be monstrous as well as illegal. In 1971, Mrs. Ora Spittler McFarland petitioned Judge Harold D. Stump of DeKalb County, Indiana Circuit Court to engage in a covert, compulsory sterilization of her 15-year-old daughter, Linda K. Spittler. Although Linda was promoted each year with her class, Mrs. McFarland opined that she was, quote, somewhat retarded and had begun to stay out overnight with older youths. And we all know what that can lead to. Judge Stump quickly signed the order, and the judge and mama hustled Linda into hospital, telling her it was for an appendicitis operation. Linda was then sterilized without her knowledge. 2 years later, Linda married a Leo Sparkman and discovered that she had been sterilized without her knowledge. The Sparkmans proceeded to sue mama, mama's attorney, the doctors, the hospital, and Judge Stump, alleging a half dozen constitutional violations. All of these people, in truth, had grossly violated Linda's rights and aggressed against her. All should have been made to pay and pay dearly for their monstrous offense. But the federal district court ruled otherwise. First, it ruled that Mama, her lawyer, and the various members of the, quote, healing professions were all immune because everything they did had received the sanction of a certified judge. And second, Judge Stump was also absolutely immune because he had acted in his capacity as a judge. Even though the district court had acknowledged that he had had an erroneous view of the law. So not only is a judge immune, he can confer his immunity in a king-like fashion, even onto lowly civilians who surround him. The U.S. Court of Appeals, Seventh Circuit, unaccountably didn't understand the program, and so it reversed the district court, claiming that Judge Stump had forfeited his immunity, quote, because of his failure to comply with the elementary principles of due process, and therefore, in a sense, quote, not acted within his jurisdiction. To allow Stump's decision to stand, said the appeals court, would be sanctioned to, quote, tyranny from the bench. Now, this was pretty flimsy stuff, and besides, it opened an entertaining wedge towards holding judges accountable to the law and to the protection of rights like everyone else. But this would also have shaken the foundations of our monopoly archist legal system. And so the U.S. Supreme Court on March 28th set the matter straight in a 5-3 decision in this illuminating case of Stump versus Sparkman. Justice Byron White, speaking for the majority, sternly reminded the appellate court of the meaning of the 1872 ruling. A judge will not be deprived of immunity because of the action he took was in error, was done maliciously, or was in excess of his authority, Rather, he will be subject to liability only when he has acted in the clear absence of all jurisdiction. Justice White conceded that no state law or court ruling anywhere could be said to have authorized Judge Stump's action. But the important point, he went on, is that there is no statute or ruling which prohibited such an action by the judge. Therefore, even though Stump had approved the sterilization order without legal authorization, without holding a hearing, without notice to the child, or without being represented by a lawyer or guardian, it was still a judicial act and therefore beyond the law. Backing Justice White were Justices Warren Berger, Harry Blackmun, William Rehnquist, who just retired, and John Stevens. Ugh, this makes me mad just reading it. For the minority, Justice Potter Stewart, joined by Lewis Powell and Thurgood Marshall, argued that the judge's authorization action was beyond the pale of anything that could sensibly be called a judicial act. And he pointed out that Stump's action was in no way an act normally performed by a judge. Indeed, there is no reason to believe that such an act has ever been performed by any other Indiana judge before or since. In a ringing statement, Stewart concluded, "A judge is not free, like a loose cannon, to inflict indiscriminate damage whenever he announces that he is acting in his judicial capacity." Ah, Justice Stewart, but apparently and unfortunately, he is so free. Outrage? Yes, but why would there be shock and surprise? White and his allies were simply being thick as judges, guildsmen defending their guild privileges, and were defending the very cornerstone of our Arcus system, the immunity from the law of the ultimate decision makers. Removing such immunity strikes at the very heart of that system and paves the way for a truly free America in which white rights would be protected fully, in which no man or group of men would be above the law or would have compulsory monopoly of judicial services. So, let's talk about this for a minute here. And this is what I'm talking about. The judiciary is supposed to be an independent arbiter, but they are nothing more than a rubber stamp for whatever tyranny that the judges, you know, want to do or whatever the government is trying to do. So, and that's what exactly what Rothbard was saying, and it's when I use that quote all the time from his Anatomy of Liberty, that he said that the judiciary is a vote of unconstitutional is a powerful check on government actions. But conversely, a vote of constitutional goes a long way towards allowing for the people to understand and comply with what the judiciary and what the government is trying to set down. You know, just like Roe versus Wade. You know, abortions had been illegal, and the Supreme Court came along and said, boom, they're legal, and that's it. And that, even though people are still fighting, hey, nothing has changed since that day in 1973. There is still more and more and more Planned Parenthoods going up, and even though there is a very large percentage of the population that is dead set against it. Anything that you want to look at that is being ruled on by the Supreme Court, we really have to take a look at whether the government or the court itself has the constitutional authority, because the authority of the our government, which is only supposed to be the protection of the rights of the individual, that is the only legitimate reason to have a government at all. And that's why you hear all these anarchists out there saying, I don't want this, I want nothing, okay? Because of the simple fact that this system doesn't work. We cannot go back to the Constitution. We can't go back, because we would have to reverse all of these different decisions that were handed down by the Supreme Court, all these different laws that have been handed down, created the code that is the U.S. Code of Laws written. It can't be undone. It has to be removed. We cannot go back to a this constitutional type of government. It is too far gone. It needs to be broken down to its lowest common denominator and then rebuilt again with the fact that the rights of the individual are what the idea, you could sum it up in like one sentence. It, no force or fraud shall be committed to another person, and no person shall commit force or fraud on another human being. That's it. Those are our rights. That is the basis of government, for any legitimate government. Let me put it that way. So I'd love to hear from you, 800-313-9443. I don't have a whole lot more to say on this subject because I have carped on it a lot on this show, but I came across when I was going through the Mises.org website, and I was looking through the Murray Rothbard. They have pretty much everything he's ever written up there for free. So if you are ever just searching the net and want to look at what a real libertarian Austrian economist, standpoint on these things are, I urge you to look it up because they have so much free information that it would take years and years and years to look through it all. And just some of their articles are really, really fascinating. And some are dry and some are, I find economics to be extremely boring. But if we need to understand what economics are in order to understand another facet of what this government is doing. So it's just, it's nuts. And another thing I wanted to talk about before we go to the break here is I have an article, this is just talking about from Camille Paglia, who is the feminist, I call her a feminazi, like Rush Limbaugh used to call me. I think when I used to, that name stuck with me ever since I used to listen to Rush Limbaugh. But she wrote an article in the New York Times on June 25th. That says, no sex, please, we're middle class. And it said that she's basically making the point, you're seeing some of these liberals even coming around. Someone as liberal as she is are saying, wow, this stuff is really messed up. She's saying, will women soon have a Viagra of their own? Although a FDA advisory panel recently rejected an application to market the drug, Phil Banzerin in the United States for Women with Low Libido and endorsed the potential benefits, urged further research. Several pharmaceutical companies are reported to be well along in the research for such a drug. Last thing the government wants is for the women to get horny again because they're already trying to, because that's what happens, like we were talking about in the other article, that, things happen. When people get excited or whatever, babies get made. And that's the opposite of what the government wants. And it says the implication is that the new pill, despite its unforeseen side effects, is necessary to cure the sexual malaise that appears to have sunk over our country. Only the diffuse New Age movement, inspired by nature-keyed Asian practices, has preserved the radical vision of the modern sexual revolution. But concrete power resides in America's careerist technocracy, for which the elite schools, with their ideological views of gender and social construct, are feeder cells. When we come back on Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock, and the revolution continues with me, Jet Lacy, I'm going to finish up this article real quick and go to John in Tennessee. I heard you calling into the last show. You had a really, really good point, so I look forward to hearing what you got to say about my show today, John. We'll be right back in just a minute. Hold on.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
We've got to get it together. It's getting better, better. We got to get together. Yeah. It's getting better and better. We got to get it better and better. Oh, till we talk. Oh, till we talk.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence, Ernest Hancock, and the revolution continues. Me, Jet Lacy. We got to work to get it together, people. I'm telling you, or it's going to be a lot worse. We have to realize that things are not not doing so good. We have, but it's between peoples. It's between individuals. And I want to finish up this article real quick before I go to John in Tennessee. So hold on just a second. And it said, in the discreet white-collar realm, men and women are interchangeable, doing the same based work. Physicality is suppressed, voices are lowered, and gestures curtailed in sanitized office space. Men must neuter themselves, while ambitious women delay procreation. Sorry. Androgyny is bewitching in art, but in real life it can lead to stagnation and boredom, which no pill can cure. Meanwhile, family life has put middle-class men in a bind. They are simply cogs in a domestic machine commanded by women. Contemporary moms have become virtuoso super managers of a complex operation focused on the care and transport of children, but it's not so easy to snap over from Apollonian control to Dionysian delirium. Nor are husbands offering much stimulation in the male display department. Visually, American men remain perpetual boys, as shown by the bulky t-shirts, loose shorts, and sneakers they wear from preschool through midlife. The sexes, which used to occupy intriguingly separate worlds, are suffering from overfamiliarity, a curse of the mundane. There's no mystery left. And one other thing, American actresses have desexualized themselves, confusing sterile athleticism with female power. And pharmaceutical companies will never find the holy grail of a female Viagra. Not in this culture driven and drained by middle-class values. Inhibitions are stubbornly internal, and lust is too fiery to be left to the pharmacist. So I can't believe this is how topsy-turvy this world is we have hardcore feminists coming in and saying our society has been too demasculinized or emasculated. Women are starting to want men to be men again, and we so need that. And I've done whole shows on this, and I'm probably going to do my very next one on there if we don't talk about the Axiom Festival. But I'm going to go to you, John, in Tennessee. We've got a couple of minutes. What's on your mind, brother?
Oh, first of all, Manny was telling me that I was on Bill Carnes. What was it about? I didn't know. Calling them.
I guess it must have been a replay. Sorry, but
okay. Well, anyway, you know, there's an old song, Jet, that comes to mind on how to get a woman in the mood, and it was an old Motown song, I believe. It was, you got to treat her like an angel and love her like the devil when you turn out the lights. I guess it was Charlie Rich.
Or Conway Twitty. Wasn't that Conway Twitty?
Woman,
yeah.
Well, whoever it was knew what they were talking about, because if you want a woman to love you, you got to love her first. You know, you got to treat her like she's something more than anything you can get anywhere else. But that's not the reason that I called. Why I called, you know, Jetty, it all comes back around to this dirty little hidden secret of America called eugenics.
Yes.
It goes back, here we are, we're repeating history because we don't know it, we're doomed to repeat it. From the 1920s, and you know this, till the 1970s, we've had a hidden thing called forced sterilization, and we're repeating it again. We're causing people that, because of their mentality or something that we see in them that we deem to be undesirable, we say, no children for you. And to me, it's criminal, Jet.
You bet. Hey, thanks so much for the call, John. When we come back in 1 minute time, we're going to keep talking with Randy and